the challenge, the opportunity to connect. The 1960s, a time of imagination and change, a time of anger and fear. The 1960s, a program called Challenge.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Looked at our connections, our divisions, through the lens of faith. Nearly 60 years later, during these challenging times, we'll take a new look at our divisions, our connections, in a new program called Challenge 2.0.
The Keystone XL pipeline has been fast-tracked for construction by the White House. It would cross Native American reservations in both Montana and South Dakota. Tribes in those states argue it would violate their most basic treaty rights. Tribal leaders throughout North America contend this is only the latest in a series of violations of their treaty rights in both the United States and Canada. That's the focus, then, of this chapter of Challenge 2.0, Paper Promises. Well, we are very fortunate to have two wonderful guests with deep knowledge of these topics tonight. I'd first like to introduce Jay Julius, who is the former Lummi Nation tribal chairman. And Jay, thank you so much for joining us. We also have Terry Kylo, who's serving as executive director of Paths to Understanding, formerly Tracy Levine Center. And Terry has a great deal of interest in this topic as well. So I would say to both of you, thank you very much for joining us. And we have a great deal to talk about here. Jay, what I'd like to do is begin with you. What were your earliest memories of family? In particular, what stories do you remember, perhaps around the kitchen table or in other settings, of the 1855 treaty signing?
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. Man, I've got so many. Growing up in a home with my grandfather, who led Lummi Nation for many years, was a part of 11 leaders. But one memory that really stands out for myself in my three terms of leadership with Lummi Nation is the importance of the treaty and what the treaty really is to our people, and not to just us, but let's just say all citizens of Washington State. Lummi Nation is in Bellingham, Washington, or our elders will say Bellingham is in Lummi Nation's territory. That was probably the most significant conversations I was engaged with as a young kid, or heard my grandfather talking about the most, was really going into detail what the treaty is and the perception of the treaty from outside communities. And really, it stemmed into a conversation of the school systems really failing to teach the true history of what a treaty is. Simple things like Article 6 of the United States Constitution specifically stating that a treaty with the United States is a supreme law, the supreme law of the land. So what does that mean? And my grandfather would always have these conversations with elders, with members of the community, within the home, and that really comes to mind for myself.
History, of course, as taught, we know is very powerful. There is the history that is taught, and there is the history that is omitted. Terry, I might ask your reflection on what Jay has just said in terms of how general is the knowledge of that as taught in schools these days?
Well, I remember myself growing up watching TV programs on Saturday afternoon, watching Little House on the Prairie, who the good guys were and who supposedly the bad guys were. And then when I went through school, I certainly didn't. There was always a nagging question in my head. Well, what about the people who were here first? But that question was really glossed over. And actually, even today, with my daughters having graduated in 2012, they really did not understand anything about the history of conquest and of domination of indigenous peoples, even in our own area. It just was omitted. Columbus came over and then great things began. And any history before the start of Anacortes, Washington, where I live, any history before 1492 was kind of like, it just sort of disappeared from their memory.
Jay, as you talk and observe what is being taught in schools throughout Washington State, How many blank spots are there, and what needs to be done to address those blank spots?
Oh my goodness, there are so many blank spots that need to be addressed, and I think we're all familiar with the term, the truth shall set you free. And I am big on not pointing the finger on moments in history, to point blame, to blame shift or anything like that. But true history, I think, is really important when you see surfacing of perception toward a people, toward a culture. I think history is important. I had, I've got a dear friend who many probably know, and you know, I was on a Zoom call with him this morning, sharing thoughts together, sharing prayer regarding these times, and his name is Jake Locker, and we have a lot in common in terms of hunting and family, and just a longtime family friend of my wife's brother. My uncles went to school with his father and uncles, but he's a history major. And when engaging in these conversations, and we launched the first inaugural Treaty Day recognition at Ferndale High School, and we did a video, and it was interesting to hear Jake say that he learned more about where he lived in that short video and short period of time, and it hurt him internally, the fact that he didn't know this history. Even though he's a history major, there are so many blank spots that are missed, and he has developed this hunger to learn more about history, about our culture. And again, it's not to learn it for the wrong reasons, it's just to understand history. But then equally important, understand this is a people who has been here since time immemorial, and for hundreds of generations, this garden that our Creator, God, created for us and sustained us since time immemorial. In 165 years, we're in this reality that we're in now. Six generations, our world has completely transformed. So I think there's a lot of blank spots and a lot of struggles to understand why it is we face the struggles we face. And we're not one to open up and tell the story of why. I think it's important to, but you know, the historical traumas of yesterday are still a reality that we live today. The struggles we face today and the things that we combat today and we're trying to overcome, there's a history there that tells the story, and it's a deep history, but you know, we're fighting to get through it. So a lot of blanks that need to be filled.
I think it might be worthwhile as we talk about history. Lummi Nation has some wonderful videotapes that you have a YouTube channel. Could you just briefly, and we'll put it up on the screen, but the name of the production channel that you have on YouTube that people could obtain more information?
Absolutely. Daryl Hilaire's former chairman of the Lummi Nation, a recognized, acknowledged leader here in Whatcom County, Man of the Year Award. He's very humble. He won't speak this way of himself, but just a phenomenal human being. He founded a nonprofit company called Children of the Setting Sun Productions. And there's a great story behind that, which I will not go into. But we, during this time of a pandemic, during this time of uncertainty, this time of crisis, this time that is new to all of us here today, we had a conversation and thought, how can we bring positive thoughts and positive things going on in the world, bring hope during these times of crisis? Because if we turn on the news, all we see is scary things, and why not acknowledge the good? So One From the Heart was given birth from that, and we have been running it for a couple of months now, and it varies from last week. We had educators on, we had a climate conversation. You know, what is Mother Earth feeling right now? What is she saying? And one of the things that came to my heart was she's taken a deep breath, a sigh of relief, just for a short moment in time, from our chaos, from our busyness, from our everything that takes place in the world. as we know it as our norm, there's a deep breath being taken by all of our givers of life. Mm-hmm. Something that's important to all of us, God's garden, this place we call home.
As we talk about what existed before for members of Lummi Nation, other tribes in the Northwest around the United States, the process of signing the treaty in 1855 and adapting to the requirements must have been intensely stressful. What expectations, if you could tell us a little bit more about that, and also the expectations that your ancestors had as they signed that treaty, and then the reality that they discovered afterward.
Those conversations at the breakfast table, lunch table, dinner table at my grandfather's home, I remember one so vividly when he pounded on the table and he said, the first shackles that were the first, we envisioned shackles and prisoners, and we had 1 year to vacate our homes that we had since time immemorial. So from January 22nd, 1855 to January 22nd, 1856, we had to vacate all these longhouses that in places where our people, our ancestors were buried, the sand that our ancestors walked on forever. And he said, if you can imagine the canoes shackled together like a bunch of prisoners, heads down, and the pain that they must have felt, having to leave these places that connected them to history and to the earth and to who we were and our names, and then going to this little reservation. But then following that, why is the treaty so important, and how has it played out in the last 165 years? You can look at the court cases. You can look at the history, 1895 for us, in 1905 with the Alaska Packers. And early on, it wasn't about fish. It wasn't about salmon and heavy industry. It was about timber. It was about the lime and some other things. And it took a while to settle here because it was challenged. It was a challenging place to live back in those days, and many of the settlers who came in early married Native American women, and that was part of our history and our way of life, was when we met other leaders, that's how we created relationships. So there's a lot of history here that led up, but for us, what was really important was healthcare. Obviously, when Governor Stevens signed this treaty on behalf of you, Jeff and Terry, and your ancestors entered into the treaty with this sovereign here for us, Lummi Nation, it was important to secure health care. It was important for Governor Stevens to include health care, education. But for us, culture is fish and fish is culture. It is the number one education, and that's where still today we learn more about who we are and more about life when we're on the water, connected as one. That's who we are. So it was important to secure that and reserve those birthrights, those rights that in the long line, hundreds of generations of being fishermen and one with the water. We face challenges every year, and my son will be a future leader of Lummi Nation, and he will face the same challenges as my grandfather faced and as I've faced. One of the biggest fights that I was a part of with our tribal leadership that really taxed me physically, emotionally, and I slept it, I dreamt it. It just consumed me. Was the coal port proposal, where 52 million tons of coal would have been piled on my ancestors, an archaeological site that is registered as a cemetery through the state. But there was still that challenge in the federal process and in the state process to do what is necessary for economics, regardless of what was there. And I don't want to go into that too much. I'm sorry if I drift, but One of the conversations I had was with a pastor friend of mine. I wanted them to stand with us on moral ground. You know, if this were happening in Anacortes on a cemetery, you got, and there was headstones and crosses that this coal was going to be dumped upon, that is not moral. It is not okay, right? So I asked them if they could stand with us and say, hey, just because there's no crosses and headstones doesn't take the significance of what is there and what is important to them and their culture and the history. And we couldn't get that. They didn't want divide, and that's okay. But those are some of the challenges we faced.
Terry, as you hear Jay speak and you hear how they reached out for support for community with various religious organizations, faith communities, how does that strike you? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think in many ways that goes right back to the to a long, deep history within Christianity, in which Jesus started off saying that when the disciples were saying who would be the greatest among them, he said, "It will not be so among you." The rulers of the Gentiles, and he was talking about the Roman Empire, lorded over them and are tyrants over them. In other words, that they were doing domination, using domination upon other people to get what they wanted economically. And Jesus said, "It will not be so among you." But by about the fourth century, the Emperor Constantine basically took over Christianity and made it to a large degree, not completely, not totally, but to a very deep, in a very deep way, made Christianity a tool of empire. And so what we're seeing is that there is a kind of a deep white Christian supremacy that has filtered Christianity through it to many of the Christian pastors and churches today, where they might recognize that something's wrong, but many of their congregational members will be uncomfortable talking about those issues because there are some deep assumptions about the supremacy or the greater importance of Christians, and particularly white Christians, over others. And so it's a very difficult thing, because when you have benefited from the oppression of other people, you want to dehumanize them. And the other piece is this, that sometimes in facing our history, we Christians don't trust God enough to forgive us and our ancestors and help us to bring a new day. Mm-hmm. And so it is immensely complex. But I hope that over time, Christians will become more free to stand with people when they need us to stand with them.
As we look at these issues, and in the introduction to this program, we related one of the most current ones, and that is of the Keystone Pipeline and the various violations of treaty rights there. Jay, I would ask maybe that you could take us back and unpack for us, if you will, the foundation of the legal status of the treaty. I know just in talking prior to this program, I learned so much. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the legal foundation for that, the constitutional foundation for that, the relationship that's inherent in a signed treaty.
I know there's a thing called Indian law, and Indian law isn't necessarily designed to protect Indian rights. We face many challenges legally, and as you know, legal decisions that have come down in the past affect or dictate decisions made today, whether they're right or wrong. It's those past decisions that they reflect on, and we've naturally faced some challenges in many tribes, not just Lummi Nation, but tribes across this country are having horrible, terrifying decisions made against them because of past cases. But for us, I'm really grateful, because our leaders here at Lummi, they're a national example, and they're very common sense oriented. We're brought up as kids to really go out and get an education. It's important for us to get an education, but not at the expense of who we are as a people. And you talk to our elders today, they don't want to hear a legalistic conversation about why we should do something. They want you to maintain the leaderistic common sense approach, because our ancestors, my grandfather, and our past leaders were so rich with common sense. They simplified things, because if you break it down and make it too complicated and worry about constituents and what people are going to think about you and forget who you are, then you're not serving your nation or doing your nation any favors. You're actually harming. It's important to remember common sense and keep it simple. So the IRS, for example, one of our cases in the late 70s was demanding that we pay taxes on our treaty reserved right to fish. And Lummi Nation said, no, if you've read Billy Frank's book, in the first page of one of his books, it's his acknowledgement and thanks to Lummi Nation for standing up and sending the jewel James to DC, who slept on a couch, who had no money, but had a legal background, went to school to be an attorney, amongst other things, and is just this fierce leader and great man. And we had success. So that was one of the first legal foundations. And then, of course, you had the Bolt decision prior to that, which took place in 1974. The decision came out in 1974, but the history was long before it. The Indian Wars that my grandfather and great-grandfather faced, the challenges to go out and exercise these rights, not privileges, not state privileges, but reserved rights to harvest salmon, to have access to salmon, to feed our communities, to feed ourselves. So the Bolt decision, Lummi Nation was a part of that, instrumental part of that. Our testimony, my great-grandfather was Felix Solomon. I share his name with him. It was passed down to myself. It is Wetotlam. And he is a ReefNet owner, and our status as ReefNet owners is passed down from generation to generation for many, 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 many centuries, and it's unwritten law. So he was instrumental in the Bolt decision, and divers and experts going down to show that we weren't just telling stories, but the divers going down in 1971 and my great-grandfather sitting out there lining up the islands, and my great-grandfather saying, in the language, it's right here, well, you won't find one or two generations of reef nets here, you're gonna find hundreds. And sure enough, they go down and take this picture, and still intact were the cedar ropes and the giant reef net anchors made from rocks, and just these mounds of them showing the history. So there are many legal cases, and today we still face many legal battles. And the reality that we're in now, I often share for us to understand why we fight, and when I'm gone and when I'm an ancestor, why they will still be fighting, is we have to go back to, you know, I pose a question to Terry, why is the, or anybody who has faith and believes in scripture, why is the Jordan River sacred to you? And we all naturally go back to that moment with John the Baptist and Jesus and that baptism that took place. And then one would argue, well, that water's gone and it flowed into what, the Dead Sea? So what makes that sacred? And it really puts it into perspective. And I say that with some humor, but really, we need to create empathy, not sympathy, not pity. But how do you create that empathy for the importance of that treaty? And for us, it's important to go back to pre-contact and life as we knew it forever. Yes, we're probably never going to get that way unless God, Earth, a complete restoration takes place, because we fail to create restoration ourselves, and we continue to be blind to the fact that we are doing some serious damage to this place that we inhabit, and we only have one of them. So I believe restoration is going to take place either way, but for us, it's important to fight the good fight because we have future generations that we have a responsibility to the unborn to leave this place at least as we got it, but it should be better. So I think we're in a world right now that is normal for us, but it's not normal. It's not healthy. It's not okay. And we, you know, you guys suffer, and you have, you know, people who have been taken from different things like cancer, addiction, alcoholism, whatever the case may be. I just, for us, we're time travelers, and it's important to go back in time because this once was just the purest place on earth, and where we are today, we can do better. And I'm hopeful, thankful to our leaders, whether I support their policies or not. I'm thankful for the sacrifice, and I maintain hope that we're going to do better.
I think that's a wonderful place, and there was such richness of your description and of Terry's observations. There's no question there's a lot more material we'd like to explore. And so you both graciously agreed to do a second episode. And so we're going to pick up this conversation next week in our next edition of Challenge 2.0. And I would ask each of you that are watching or listening to join us again then. Thank you very much. And thank you, Jay and Terry. If you've enjoyed this program, please give us 5 stars and leave a review. If you can also tell one friend about the show, that would be great. You can find us on social media at Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find out more and financially support the show at PathsToUnderstanding.org. The program is hosted by executive producer Jeff Renner, produced by Tom Butterworth and John Sharifi. Cameras and audio by Rich McAdams, Tom Butterworth, and Dean Puccio. Ian Olson is the production assistant.